It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is National Poetry Month. And maybe that sounds irrelevant or even frivolous, given the urgency and the gravity of the issues that make the news every day. But today, we argue that poetry has everything to do with the news, beginning here, with a brand new poem ripped straight from the headlines.
Inaugural. Let me repeat. Of the different varieties, it's the guilt of being one without the attendant narratives of fire and night. Children littering the shore like sea glass, or walking across entire continents, souls bloodied, coupled with the fact that I've never used the word to describe myself, not once in 43 years until today. Refugee. Yes, I have always called myself an immigrant, but it is only now in this icy light that I bend my knee and bow, the top of my head sword-kissed. Once I got on a plane. I left. It was done. I became me. I did not suffer in the way of such suffering, but I am a refugee from a war this country conducted. May this be the dawn of an era in which we do not have to live a particular life in order to respect it. The way 19th century art brought us the word empathy. Before then, there was only a luminousness we had to believe was there.
Quan Barry is an award-winning poet and novelist. She was born in Saigon and raised in the U.S., and she's an English professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is the same campus where I work, so I see her around town. A few weeks ago, Quan emailed that poem to me and to a few other friends, and she also announced that for the rest of the year, she's going to be writing and publishing one new poem a week in response to current events. Now, as a journalist, I think this sounds great. So we got together here in the studio to talk about starting a new radio series, The News from Poems. Okay, does that work?
I will try it.
Okay, good. That's great. I love that. Amy, tell me about writing that poem. What was going on in the world, in the news, in your mind?
So I wrote this poem roughly the week before the inauguration, but the poem has a bit of a backstory. So in October of 2016, I met the writer Viet Thanh Nguyen, who won the Pulitzer Prize last year for his novel about a Vietnam spy who comes to the United States, a novel called The Sympathizer. You know, I know in reading some of his works that he always refers to himself as a refugee, and he is a refugee. His family, they were boat people. They lived that very particular exodus from Vietnam. But for me, I've never really thought of myself as a refugee because I don't have that story.
How did you come here?
I was born in 1973, and I left Vietnam in 1974 when I was 6 months old. I was put up for adoption. I don't know anything about my biological family. I simply got my passport, I got on a plane, I left, the rest is history. So I've never identified as a refugee. But obviously, in thinking about things that have been happening recently, you know, we're only thinking specifically about like Muslim immigration, Muslim refugees, and realizing that refugees come in all shapes and sizes, and that I now need to count myself among this population. I need to let people know that, you know, refugees like me don't have accents. There are many ways in which people would never think of me as being a refugee. People don't even think of me as being an immigrant. And so I felt like it was really important for me, like I said, to stand up and be part of this population.
Hmm. So you wrote this poem as part of a larger project that you've just launched online and also here with us on this show. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
It's a website called asphodel.info, the news from poems. That particular name comes from a poem, a long poem that was written by William Carlos Williams in 1955, in which he says, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there."
What does that mean to you, the news from poems?
So I think what he's saying is this idea that the news can give us facts, but it's poetry, it's art that asks us as readers or as viewers to do a certain kind of work to interpret these things, and that particular work is sustaining. You know, it nourishes us. So like many people, I watched the elections, I watched the lead up to the elections, the 2 years, you know, how we actually arrived at this particular moment. And November 9th, many of us in this country woke up and thought, the world is a world that I hadn't previously imagined. And for me, it's really important for artists and for all of us as individuals to leave a footprint behind. You know, oftentimes we talk in terms of carbon footprints, but I think of this as an artistic footprint to sort of document another way of looking at things.
We should explain what this project actually is. Mm-hmm. I kind of skipped that part earlier.
The way it's been currently structured is that I myself, each and every week, have just been posting one poem that I've written that somehow is informed by happenings in the world. But now I'm looking to expand that project. So for National Poetry Month, which is the month of April, I feel very lucky to have signed on 4 amazing poets. So there'll be a different poet each week sharing their views of what it's like to currently be living in this particular culture.
That sounds fantastic. And I also think you're, with the William Carlos Williams reference, saying that there are things that artists, that poets can see and document that journalists can't. So what, for instance, do you think a poet could document that might not show up in the news otherwise?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily a question of subjects. I don't think there's any subjects that a poet could document that a journalist couldn't. I think it's a question of ambiance. It's the idea of moving beyond the facts. I was thinking of it almost in terms of like a restaurant. You know, if you go into a restaurant, this is what you ate, but what was the atmosphere? What were the other kinds of things? And to me, that's what artists and poets can document. It's that other stuff. Like I said, it's a world beyond facts.
Poetry deals with the realm of the irrational, and that once you're in that world, there are feelings, things, insights that are going to come up that are not going to in the, you know, the journalistic world of objective reality.
Absolutely. So when we think in terms of the irrational, you know, there have been many poets who've written about it, many of the Spanish surrealist poets of the early 1900s. There's this idea of something called duende, which nobody can quite put their finger on what that word even means. Like, is it the irrational? Is it the idea of living in the presence of death? Again, nobody can quite put their finger on it. The American poet Robert Bly talked in the 1960s about this idea of the reptilian brain is what he referred to it. He would argue that that particular remnant in our brain somehow goes back to when we were reptiles. And yet that particular aspect of our brain still has wisdom and still has knowledge in it, but that we have difficulty accessing it because it is irrational in certain kinds of ways.
Are you also, with News from Poems, wanting to redefine in any way what we consider to be news? This is something I think about a lot, because if you pick up a newspaper or if you, you know, look at CNN or listen to NPR for that matter, you're going to get a certain category of stories. A lot of them are going to be negative because that's sadly what makes news. But why isn't it also news that the first robin showed up today? Why isn't it also news that 2,700 5-year-olds walked to school today? I mean, there's so many, what we consider to be news has to do with what we pay attention to, what we notice. And that, you know, as you were saying, is the art of poetry, is to pay attention. So I'm wondering if you're wanting to use poetry as a way to encourage us to pay attention to different things.
I think that's absolutely true. I hadn't thought of it with respect to the word news itself, but poetry in many ways is about being in the present. It's about celebrating the present moment, because sometimes we can get lost in the fog of all kinds of things that are happening. I do think that in many ways, poetry can help sort of expand the ways in which we take in news. You know, in the old days, you got a newspaper,
yeah,
and then maybe you got radio, and then we had TV. And obviously now, because of the internet, you know, news is looking very, very different than it used to. You think about Twitter, you think about 140 characters, right? So I feel like more and more news actually is becoming poetry rather than poetry becoming the news.
Say that again. I love that.
Well, so in thinking about it, I'm really kind of interested in this. So oftentimes when I talk about literature with my students, I'm always telling them that they know a lot when it comes to fiction. They know a lot about fiction because we all have seen movies, we watch TV, they've read novels. So they know things about how stories are told, right? But oftentimes when it comes to poetry, people think that they don't know anything about poetry because it's not in our culture. And yet the truth of the matter is that poetry is in our culture, but in many ways, it's actually as advertising. There's a whole way in which we interact with poetry on a daily basis without maybe recognizing it as such.
I so love it. The idea that here I think that I'm surrounded by ads and I have Coca-Cola jingles and the ads for Virgin America or whatever. Maybe it's all just poetry coming at me.
You know, in a way it is. And again, obviously it's used for various effects, but it's the idea if you think of poetry as being compressed and charged language, then that kind of is what advertising is. So yeah.
And what about Twitter? Is Twitter a giant poetry feed?
You know, in many ways, again, the idea of the word poetry comes from the Greek poieo, which basically means to make. So basically a poem at the end of the day is a made thing. Poets are makers. So if you have that really broad definition for what poem is, then yeah, then Twitter and all its pros and cons could be considered a poem.
Well, but this suggests that we're living in this age of the democratization of poetry in which we have all become makers.
I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that in many ways this is sort of the best of times for poems. You think about seeing poems on buses, on the subway. You know, there's more and more students taking creative writing classes. I think that sometimes people get scared when they hear the word poetry and they think of poetry with a big P and they think of what they learned in high school. But the idea that, no, poetry can be poetry with a little P. And again, it could be in your shop. List. You know, there's a whole category of poetry called found poems.
What's a found poem?
It's almost like if you think of the really famous, is it Duchamp, urinal, like it's in the 1920s, he took a urinal, he put it in a museum, and he called it art. But it was a urinal first, but then again, it was a found art piece. So found poetry is similar. You take a piece of already pre-existing writing, and you either format it as a poem, you title it, and voila, you have a poem.
The other thing I love about the idea of Twitter and Facebook posts and Snapchats and Instagrams, all of these as forms of poetry, and the idea that we've all become participants in this endless stream of making, there's something to me that is so hopeful and healing about that, especially in the face of the now 24/7 news cycle, which can be, you know, relentless and depressing. And I think the act of making is the exact opposite, right? Because news you receive. News is done unto you in a way. Making is maybe the therapy.
Mm-hmm. In thinking about it, that obviously, you know, we make individually. But I do think that there's something about it that speaks to community and speaks to connection. Oftentimes when we make things, we are kind of thinking about an audience, even, you know, if we're not thinking consciously about audience. And so I do think that, like I said, that there's this element of community, connection, outreach that's present in that process.
Well, this is very hopeful. Amy, thanks.
Thank you.
Amy Kwan Barry is the author of 4 books of poems and also a novel called She Weeps Each Time You're Born. She's an English professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's curating our new poetry project, The News from Poems. You can find her poem and more on our website at ttbook.org. And next week, we'll hear new work from Palestinian-American poet Fadi Judah. If I say poet, what kind of person comes to mind? Emily Dickinson in her white dress? Robert Frost with his horse in someone else's snowy woods, or maybe someone still alive, like Rita Dove or Richard Blanco. They're all part of the canon, major poets with established reputations. But who's next? Aren't there some edgy, boundary-breaking poets we should be reading? Well, Stephen Burt is the person to ask, the young Harvard professor who's considered the leading poetry critic of a new generation, and who's been making a conscious effort to introduce new and different voices to the canon. Stephen's just come out with a new anthology called The Poem Is You, and stopped by our studio to talk with our Steve Paulson.
Yeah, and so you should talk sort of be facing into the mic, obviously.
And slow down a little bit because it's radio.
Don't worry, just be yourself. You don't have to slow down.
Okay.
That's fine.
Names and pronouns and things, Stephen or Steph. Mm-hmm. In person, and I like they if you're comfortable with it, but
I want to ask you about this.
Okay.
So
are we recording?
We are, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So do you go more by Stephen or more by Steph?
I prefer Steph, but Stephen is just fine, and all the books say Stephen, and it's not a favor to your publishers or to readers who will never meet you if you say, now that I'm out as somebody who's a girl inside, somebody who's got two genders, you've got to go and change the name on all my books. People do that, of course. Trans people who make full social and legal transitions, of course, do that. And one of my favorite comic book artists, Sophie Campbell, who is out as a trans lady, came out after she had begun her comic book career, and her comic book publisher obligingly went and reprinted her early work so that her correct name, Sophie, is now on all of them.
That's dedication there.
Well, it's actually just politeness. If you're a comic book company and you can afford to do that, you right. should if your author requests it. But it turns out I don't need that. I'm Stephen and Steph, and I'm a boy and a girl, and I have two genders, and that's my life.
And you do some poems. You've written some poems in the voice
yes.
of Stephanie, right?
Yeah. I have a chapbook, which is a short staple-bound book. It's like an EP instead of an LP, if you're a music person, called All Season Stephanie, which I'm very happy with. That is a series of poems about what my memories and my life would have been like had I grown up as a girl, had I been raised as a girl. And some of those are going to be in the next full-length collection of my own poems, which comes out next year. But yeah, I also answer to Stephanie. That's great. But I don't need to ask everyone who works with me professionally or who knows me personally to change what they do in the way that many trans people do ask and, you know, should be honored. But
yeah.
Stephen and Steph and Stephanie, they're all me. And the books say Stephen. So far.
Yeah. And it seems that this is relevant, what we're talking about, to your project, because, I mean, what you do as a poetry critic mm-hmm. is you're trying to bring to wider attention poets with lots of different identities, lots of different backgrounds, different voices. Is that a fair thing to say?
It is fair. And it may be that having more than the usual number of genders and more than the usual number of identities might help me be a better reader, as when I'm wearing my critic hat, which I am for this book, The Poem Is You.
So let's get a taste mm-hmm. of this. So
yeah,
from your book. So you put together this anthology
yeah.
of 60 poems,
mm-hmm.
all written by Americans since 1980,
mm-hmm.
from a wide variety.
I hope so, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And read one or two, and you've also written essays about each of these
yes,
poems.
Yes, yes. The book is 60 poems and an essay about how to read each one, what's going on in each one, why I like each mm-hmm. one. And for the ones that are very challenging or far from prose sense, I try to help it make sense. And for the ones that are more straightforward, I say other things that I hope will help you like them. So this is by one of my favorite mid-career poets. She's based in Michigan. She's been in Michigan, I think, almost her whole life. And she's also a novelist, but for me, the real distinction lies with her poetry, and this is a relatively recent poem. Her name is Laura Kosciuszko, and this is part of a series of poems about allegorical people who are modern women who are competing in imaginary pageants. And this one is called Miss Weariness. At first, she looked like all the other girls, but then the chipped fingernail, and then she sat down in a folding chair and let the other girls pass by in their ball gowns, in their bathing suits, in their beatific smiles, but she had tossed her heels aside. Enough of industry, enough of goals and troubles, looking ahead, grooming and dreaming, and anything that ended in ing in this life ever again, she said. Oh, enough even of the simple stuff. The will-o'-the-wisp, the rain on a lake, all those goldfish in their plastic baggies at the fair. To them, it must have been as if the world were divided into small, warped dreams, nowhere to get to and nothing to do but swim.
Wow.
Yeah, that just gets you. Not all contemporary American poems are that sharp or that sad. It's super sad. And it's super sad because it speaks to three different reasons why many of us are sad. One is the feeling that we've all had of futility, of where am I going? One is a feeling specific, I think, to middle class and privileged teens that were sort of being tested to death and prepared and prepared and prepared to get into the right college, to choose the right major, to choose the right life, and especially for girls, to look the right way while you're doing it. And then a third feeling that I think is part of this poem, and I write about this in the essay, is a feeling that's about parenthood and professional life, in particular for women, though not only for women, where you're never off duty, where you always have something you're supposed to do and to look good while doing it. It's what the sociologist Arlie Hochschild called the second shift, where you go home and you have more to do. And the expectations of daily life are just really tiring. And these are feelings that you can write about as an essayist or as a novelist. And Kosciuszko has put them in some of her novels, and some of her novels are terrific. But she's able to put them into her poems using techniques that she invented. There's end rhyme, lines rhyme, and there's a great deal of internal rhyme. And there's a sense of closure when that last rhyme or set of half rhymes, them, dreams, swim, bin, which is a vowel rhyme, show up. There's a lot of closure, but the rhymes, you don't know when the rhymes are coming. The lines are very, what we call, enjambed. They're broken in places that aren't sort of natural to break them. And so it's very unsettling. You don't know when your life will come together, when the pattern that makes it all worthwhile will emerge, or if one will ever emerge, or if you're just going to be swimming like those goldfish at the fair forever. And it is extremely intricate when you reread it, even though it's, I think, immediate and raw in its sadness when you read it. It's really one of those poems that hits you one way the first time and another way the 10th time, which when I'm asked what makes a poem great, what I say is I think a poem is great when you can read it 20 times and be glad you've done that and still get new things out of it. And Miss Weariness by Laura Kosciuszko is another one.
You read us one poem from your anthology. How about another one?
This is a poet who, by virtue of putting together this book, I learned more about and came to like more. And she writes out of demographic experience and social experience that I largely haven't had. And I sort of learned more about what she was doing. And I hope I've done justice to the poem. It's a poet who's been tremendously influential, who died relatively recently after a long career that also included writing children's books and writing for the musical Free to Be You and Me. She was involved in that. Again, not just a poet, but she's certainly best known for her poems. And the poet is Lucille Clifton. And this is a poem from a series of short poems that she published in the 80s and was called My Dream About the Second Coming. Mary is an old woman without shoes. She doesn't believe it. Not when her belly starts to bubble and leave the print of a finger where no man touches. Not when the snow in her hair melts away. Not when the stranger she used to wait for appears dressed in lights at her kitchen table. She is an old woman and doesn't believe it. When something drops onto her toes one night, she calls it a fox, but she feeds it. Now, people who talk about Lucille Clifton at length and who write about her as an influence write about her place in an African-American demotic tradition that also includes Hughes, that includes the later Gwendolyn Brooks. She would have been happy with that. And they talk about often her relation to African-American feminism and womanism, which is a term that I think Alice Walker coined to distinguish black feminism from white-led feminism in the 70s. And that's part of what Lucille Clifton's trying to do. And that is in this poem. This is a poem about maternal empowerment. It's also a poem about other and partly European traditions of painting and writing that Clifton is taking part in. It is an enunciation poem. There are a lot of good enunciation poems from the past few decades. Jory Graham wrote one of my favorites.
When you talk about an enunciation,
the Annunciation with a capital A is an event in sort of Christian mythography and in sort of Christian stories where the angel Gabriel shows up and tells the Virgin Mary, you know, I know you're a virgin, but you're going to have a baby anyway, and he's going to be God. And this is a popular scene with medieval and Renaissance painters and with contemporary poets who are investigating motherhood in a way that most previous generations of English language poets mostly didn't do.
As a critic, who do you see as your audience? I mean, are you mainly writing for people who are in the poetry community, or is it the wider public, people who really might not read much poetry at all?
Well, this book is for the wider community. I do write other things that are for smaller audiences. I write for blogs. I write for magazines that have 2,000-person circulation. So I do write other kinds of things. When you are writing for a larger audience, you know that not everybody who reads you is going to go out and drop $60 at their local independent bookstore on three new books of poetry. Many people use their library cards, right? If you have a library card, it's free. I don't know how many people are going to go read a lot of one or another poet I recommend, but I do think that it's a non-zero amount, and I've been doing this long enough, I sometimes get email that says, thank you for turning me on to this poet or that poet. So I think of myself as an introducer, as a kind of party host almost, as well as an explainer, an explicator, someone making arguments, and also in a way as a DJ.
Do you think we need poetry? I mean, as a society, as a culture, or is it sort of, it's a great thing if you like it, or is it more essential than that?
Well, I need poetry. I need poetry. A lot of people need poetry, though they don't all need the same poems. And it's okay if you don't like poetry. It's okay if that's not the art form for you. But I do think there are some people for whom it matters a lot, and maybe more people for whom it could matter if they encountered the poems that spoke to them. And part of my work as a public critic writing books like The Poem Is You is to say, you know, if you're curious, if you've got a few poems you like, but you don't know where to go next, or you don't know what's going on now, or you want to try this stuff out, here's a lot of poems, and I hope some of them work for you.
Stephen Bird is the leading critic of a new generation of poets and author of The Poem Is You, 60 Contemporary American Poems and How to Read Them. Stephen talked with our own Steve Paulson in our studios in Madison. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. One of the things I love about poetry is the way it gives words weight. The way it makes you slow down so you can hear everything hiding in them. Rhythm and tone, shadows and illusion. But what if your original language, your family's, your culture's language was stolen from you? Imagine missing all those words. All those layers of meaning built up over generations. Paul Wendell Jr. is a member of the Leech Lake Band of the Ojibwe in northern Minnesota, and he's trying to relearn and reclaim his native language. And what he does with it on stage as the hip-hop performer Tall Paul is revolutionary. My name is Tall Paul. I'm an alcoholic. Used to think I was an issue because I was in college. Tall Paul told Charles Monroe Kane that he didn't actually encounter the Ojibwe language until college.
Being exposed, and looks sounds like in small increments, to your culture and your language, but at the same time, you're a young man in America in an urban setting. You're immersed in hip-hop. Did you grow up in hip-hop culture? That was just part of who you were?
Yeah, somewhat. I didn't really grow up in the culture in some ways. You know, I wasn't around graph writers or break dancers, anything like that. But I was growing up in a household where hip-hop was always on. That was all we listened to, hip-hop. It's all I ever heard. Didn't hear anything else. I remember being in third grade, sitting in detention, drawing this picture of Snoop Dogg driving a lowrider. That's one clear memory that comes back to me. So, I mean, definitely I would say that I grew up into the hip-hop culture somewhat, but not extensively when it comes to the elements of hip-hop.
At some point in your life, you made a decision, and I don't know when, but you made a decision to connect your indigenous ways with hip-hop. That seems like a crazy decision to me. How did that happen?
As I got older and started becoming little by little more aware of my culture and my people, there started to develop inside of me this curiosity. You know, I wanted to know more about it. And when I got to college, you know, taking the Ojibwe language course was a part of that. I decided to do that because I want to learn more about myself and my people. And I struggled learning the language. In the Guinness Book of World Records, it was considered the most complex language to learn at one point. I don't know if it still is, but you can conjugate a verb in over 1,000 ways, you know. So I was struggling learning the language and even wanting to learn it. You know, I'm not a linguist. I didn't grow up learning different languages. But yeah, I thought maybe if I mix language in with hip hop and, you know, do some of these things, maybe it'll make the language more interesting to me, make me want to learn it more. Maybe I'll try harder with it. So that's where that idea came in as far as the language goes. And ever since then, I've always mixed in my native identity and culture here and there in different songs. Just naturally.
When you, there must have been a point as a young man in college where I would assume you're looking in the mirror, you're alone, and you spoke the Ojibwe language for the first time in a rap song. What was that like for you to hear yourself speak that language in the hip-hop form?
That was a pretty surreal experience, because I remember, you know, it was for my senior project at the University of Minnesota. I went back to the computer lab right there in the building, plugged in my beats on the iMac there. I played the beat in the computer lab, and I started rapping a song, and I started spitting that hook in Ojibwe to the section of the beat that's meant for the chorus, that 8-bar section, and it just fit perfectly, and it flowed too, and I was just like, wow, that's crazy. From there, I mean, at that point, I was just like, okay, this was supposed to happen, you know?
Can we hear it? Can I hear that chorus? Do you mind?
Yeah, yeah. Get your money, do we do kawashin? Jamushka wizzy yan, me dush, but me it is a yan. Me jishanam, zagi e way when gnu jishanam, bizendal with shanam. Me wane januga mo yan. Nima show miss, we do kawashanam. J I budget too young and nishanabe, yes, you twawin. Me jibbe, get came to mind, kaya nishanabe, be my dizzy win.
Damn, that is so badass. And as I'm hearing you do it, I'm reading the English translation. It is some deep business. Can you talk about what it means?
So basically, it's just a prayer. It's asking for help for myself, but also for all people. Asking for help for all people to just be the best people we can be, you know, be the best we can be. Treat people with respect and kindness and get back in touch with our spirituality, so that we can find stability and peace in our lives.
Did you realize at the time that you were basically the first person to ever do this?
I guess I wasn't really sure if I was the first person to do it or not. I thought I might be, but I wasn't positive. Honestly, I still don't know today, but that's what the general feeling seems to be.
Yeah, and the general feeling is for Native groups all around the country, for young people, you are a massive icon. What was it like the first time you performed for other Native people that song? It must have been powerful.
First time performing it was in school as part of my senior project. I performed it for the other Natives in my class. Mm. And that was powerful. It was a really good experience. When I go places and perform that song, I can tell that it's very powerful, and I feel it myself. There's a lot of people who come up to me and say that it's inspiring and it makes them want to learn their own culture and their own language and get more connected in those ways. And that's really why I did the song. So, yeah.
You know, you grew up tough. You had a rough time growing up, I think, and you share that experience, I think, with a lot of Native Americans, reservation or urban setting. Do you feel some obligation to young people now when you go out to reservations or to different urban schools to talk about empowerment and talk about that past and how you've overcome that?
Yeah, that's what it's all about for me. That's my responsibility as somebody who came up. You know, I grew up in the inner city, not in the best environment, went through foster care, you know, dad being in and out of prison, drug addiction all around me, went through some of those things myself, making my own mistakes. So I do find it as a privilege, but a responsibility also, to be able to go to these different communities and talk to adults, kids, whoever might hear me about my experience and, you know, how far down you can go, you know, into the depths of depression.
Yeah.
And still be able to come out of that and come to a place where it's like, wow, I've got this newfound peace of mind as a result of the hard work I've put in and keeping faith, you know, and that's definitely important to me, to be able to share my experience with people who need to hear that.
You know, this summer I took my children, they're young, 12, you know, 9, 10, especially my 12-year-old son, really into hip-hop. And we went to Pine Ridge Reservation. We were there for a powwow and spent an evening doing some other stuff as well, spending a couple of days in the area. And I was surprised how much hip-hop iconography and hip-hop ideals were all around me. Tupac, everywhere, and graffiti. Is that the thing that's going to uplift Native American people?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it already is. I feel like it uplifts so many people. It's almost like a universal language. Like you said, hip-hop is a culture. It's not just a genre. You'll have kids in the suburbs listening to it. You'll have kids in the inner city or on the reservation. Kids in third world countries listening to hip-hop. It's really just an empowering culture and music genre, and I feel like it connects to so many people and makes so many people want to fit in with it. It gives so many people something to look to. Get your money, do we do cowboy shin? Jimushka with Zion, me Dutch, but me, it is a yan. Me just a nam, I get e white when Ganu just a nam, biz and dad with a nam, me one jinugum of yan. Nima show me sweet do cowboy shin, I'm jit, I budget too young, a nishin, I'm bay is just wild when me jit big, it came to my KI.
Paul Wendell Jr. He performs as Tall Paul. He's a member of the Leech Lake Band of the Ojibwe in northern Minnesota. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him and put together a Native American hip-hop playlist for you. It's on our website at ttbook.org. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. 100 years ago, the poet Carl Sandburg turned Chicago into an American icon when he called it the City of Broad Shoulders. He wrote a series of poems describing Chicago as a gritty Midwestern metropolis teeming with hardworking immigrants. Well, now, composer David Nagler has celebrated the 100th anniversary of those poems by dusting them off and setting them to music. His new song cycle features a roster of musical heavy hitters. And this week, Charles Monroe Kane brings us a conversation with David Nagler about what those poems mean to him personally and what it feels like to contribute to the continuum of the Chicago experience.
Hog Butcher for the world.
So it was 1998, and my mother had visited the Carl Sandburg home in Flat Rock, North Carolina. My sister was, I think she was working at a summer camp down there, and my mother went to visit her. She had a day off, and she said, oh, I'll go check out the Carl Sandburg home. And she brought me back this anthology of poems called Harvest Poems. And she gave it to me at the end of the summer, not long before I went to Chicago to visit. I didn't know very much at all about Sandburg, but I knew that that was probably his most well-known work, with the exception of the Abraham Lincoln biography. And so I read it while I was there. It's these 16 poems out of Chicago poems, just about 150. And I just thought they were great. And more specifically, they just reminded me of song lyrics as I read them. And so that was sort of where it all started.
City of the Big Shoulders.
So you're reading them and you're like, yeah, these are songs. I mean, to me, that seems like a pretty big leap, because I know lyrics is poetry and all this stuff, but I got to tell you, when I heard I was going to do this interview, I had the album. I'm like, wait, I'm not going to read the album. I'm going to reread the poems. I'm a big fan of Sandberg, so I'm going to reread the poems first. And I was like, whoa, this is going to be hard. How's he going to pull this off? Like, how did you pull that off? Those aren't naturally right. Lyrics, really.
No, there were basically a handful, maybe like two or three that sort of got the idea going. In particular, the poem Mag is the big one for me. That was the one where I read it, and at the time I was listening to a lot of Randy Newman records, and the character in that poem seemed like a character from a Randy Newman song. And like Lost was another one where it seemed very, very much like a kind of atmospheric lyric that I could set to music, and it didn't have to be a very long song or anything, but I could sort of use that one.
Where fog trails and mist creeps, the whistle of a boat calls and cries unendingly.
Once I had those two, that was when it just, the idea started snowballing, and then the really challenging lyrics happened, like, oh, Chicago, how am I going to set that to music? And
seriously, no, I've got to ask you about that, because everybody who's listening right now wants to know this question I'm about to ask you. I mean,
you got to hit Hog Butcher for the World, man, or you have it. Your album's not going to work. Like, that's a lot of pressure. That's really iconic.
Yeah.
How did you pull that off? How did you pull off those famous, famous words?
Well, the one thing I can say about that is I didn't start with the intro.
That's smart.
Yes. Yeah, I was like, I'm going to put this on the back burner for now. I started with the section where it goes, they tell me you are wicked and I believe them. And it's a very kind of like conversational sort of talking lyric. You know, it was sort of like half sung, half spoken. And I was like, that's the way I would approach any other poems like that. And so I kind of plowed ahead from there, got to the end of the poem and song, and then later went back and was like, okay, I got to do something anthemic for the Hog Butcher for the World part. And then that was where that sort of idea of like a bed of strings and a trumpet melody, and then the vocal comes in and sings the melody. So that was how that happened. But I did put off the anthemic part for a bit.
You got to get into it first, right? You got to kind of feel it, and then to go back to the hard part. Who were you thinking about when you were singing that? Right? Were you thinking about Carl Sandburg? Were you thinking about your mom? Were you thinking about yourself? Like the listener? I mean, who exactly was your audience at that moment?
Well, it was as much as I knew about Sandburg at the time, which was very little. I knew very little about him. I read some of the other poems and Harvest poems, but I didn't really dive deep until I was finishing the record. But I basically went by the text. What Sandburg was trying to convey about Chicago at the time, and was just like, that is what I want to be able to project outward. I made a list of all these, you know, mostly friends, I can call them, Chicago singers and songwriters and musicians that I was like, God, it would be so great if they were on the record. And pretty much just about everyone, you know, was involved.
So wait, so you just called Jeff Tweedy up and say, hey, Jeff, could you do Theme in Yellow? and he said, sure. And Jeff, do whatever you want? Or how does that work?
It was actually via Kelly Hogan that I ended up recording some of the Chicago guests at Wilco Studio in Chicago. And it was sort of after that Chicago experience that I had where I recorded everyone, that was when the sort of momentum sort of went into play to see if Jeff was available to sing it, because as I was making that list, that song just seemed so well suited for him.
I spot the hills with yellow balls in autumn. I like the prairie cornfields, orange and tawny gold clusters, and I am called pumpkins.
Hey, tell me a little bit more about that song, because I thought I knew the Sandburg poems. I don't know this one at all. It's a fantastic poem.
Yeah.
And so you just knew you wanted Jeff to do that exact song. It's a great song for him, actually, now that you mention it. But well, how did that happen? Because, I mean, I'm looking at it, and it's really about a jack-o'-lantern, right? Like, it's not right. What you would think. How'd you pick that?
Well, there's, in the Harvest Poems collection, and it's interesting that this anthology is called Harvest Poems, because there are several poems within the Chicago poems, the poems that are taken from Chicago poems. There are many that talk about like the harvest moon,
right,
and the moon, and they have that sort of an autumnal sort of feeling to them. And that seemed to be something that Sandburg was really taken by at the time. And so Theme in Yellow, for me, took a long time to actually finish it. I didn't know where I wanted to go. And that's interesting that you mentioned the jack-o'-lantern element, because for a while it was going to be sort of like a minor key, maybe a little bit of even a scary song.
Yes, I wanted to ask you that. It's not in a minor key. Why? Like, that's really surprised me.
Really what it comes down to is I tried it and it didn't work.
Right, because I mean, I'm looking at it right here. I'm like, I am a jack-o'-lantern with terrible teeth.
Yeah.
And the children know I am fooling. There's that twist at the end, right?
Well, yeah, but that's sort of the positive, you know, major twist at the end. Ah, the children just know it's all for fun. You know, sort of that kind of vibe.
Um.
You do this upbeat song surrounding, you have Jep Tweedy sing it, and it becomes, from my understanding, looking at it on the internet and interacting with people in the media, this kind of becomes a hit. I mean, Rolling Stone and Pitchfork, people flip out over Jep Tweedy singing this song. People love it. Were you surprised by that?
Not really. I mean, Wilco's a great band, and Jeff has a lot of fans, and he just did an amazing job with it. I mean, it's like the second he sent over the vocal for me to listen to, and I heard the first word, and I immediately flipped out. It was perfect. It's what you always dream about, and then it happens, and it's even more amazing.
Fantastic. Cue music. How's that? I'll remind myself. That's beautiful, dude.
I ask professors who teach the meaning of life to tell me what is happiness. And I went to famous executives who boss the work of thousands of men.
The song Happiness. Oh my God. It's so beautiful. Can you tell me about how that came about?
Well, that was conceived in two parts. That was one of the early ones that I had written. But I definitely wanted it to be the first part. I wanted to be sort of upbeat. It was almost sort of like a hardcore song, actually, in the initial way that I had imagined it. Like, it had this sort of like hardcore, sort of punk, slightly Balkan sort of feel to it. And then I wanted the second part to be a little bit more grand and. And of course, he mentions having an accordion within the poem. And so I was like, well, there should probably be an accordion as well. And so that was the way I had, I'd always sort of imagined it. It's a song in two parts. And in fact, you know, one sort of fades out and the other one kind of fades in from there. So much to the point where even as I was finishing up the record, it was always like two separate tracks that I just had to, you know, right, put together and mastering. So,
you know, that twist at the end of that song, you know, the happiness is found by Hungarians drinking beer by a river with their women and their children and their accordions, but not by the executives and the fat cats with the cigars, you know. I must have listened to that 10 times in a row, and I'm like, oh my God, this is an old Woody Guthrie song. It felt like the way he would do it, and then you twist it. I went to this guy, and in the end, I find it with the Hungarians. Like, is there something about that time period, this time of our history, that conjures up these kind of songs?
Well, this is, I mean, at the time that he wrote this, Sandberg was a journalist. He, when he moved back to Chicago, he was in Milwaukee before that, working as, I believe, secretary to the Democratic Socialist mayor. And then he moved back to Chicago and he was working mostly as a journalist, where he would interview basically all sorts of people, and he would be on different assignments all throughout the city and sort of on the outskirts as well. And so that was, you know, this was something that to him was like kind of like a basic truth that, like, you can have all the money and power in the world, but that really doesn't mean that much in the scheme of things. Like, what you need is just like family and good times and, you know, freedom and happiness. That was sort of, I think, what Sandberg believed.
Everybody loved Chick Lorimer in our town, far off. Everybody loved her, so we all love a wild girl, keeping a hold on a dream she wants.
I'm listening to this music in the context of Donald Trump,
right?
You know, the kind of the epitome of a fat cat in a sense, you know, the cigar chomping guy. And I think to myself, a lot of people think that happiness isn't singing by the river with your women and your children, your accordions and your beer anymore. Don't you think? I mean, I think that used to be a known assumption. I don't know if it is anymore.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not taken as, but then again, I'm not sure it was taken as a given back then either.
Sure.
I mean, because there were certain people had certain aspirations, especially when you're talking about like, immigrant populations coming into the States who want to make it for themselves and feed their family and everything. And I think for we don't have that sort of drive as right. much anymore. I mean, maybe at this point there's too much cynicism. I'm it's tough to say.
Right. But I can tell you that I live in a smaller town in America, and I was thinking about this poem because I live by a river, and there was a Mexican family, very large extended Mexican family there, and the men on one level are playing soccer over here. There's somebody playing guitar. They're heating up tortillas and meat on a grill. Everyone's running around. You know, there's soda. People are cutting limes. People are laughing. And I'm saying to myself, this is the American dream. And yeah. these are the Hungarians by the river. Like, why does it take the immigrants to do that for us, I think, you know? That's what your song brought for me.
Yeah. That's a really good question. But it's, you know, if nothing else, it's just good to see that happiness is a constant, and exactly 100 years later, you know, you still see it, you know, actually taking place. That's really inspiring, I think.
Composer David Nagler talking about his musical celebration of the 100th anniversary of Carl Sandburg's famous Chicago poems. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. This was just the beginning of our celebration of National Poetry Month. Every week for the next 4 weeks, we'll be bringing you a new work by a major American poet, part of our News from Poems project. Next week, we'll hear from Fadi Judah, the Palestinian-American poet, translator, and physician. If you want to read or share any of the poems you heard this hour, you'll find them all on our website at ttbook.org, which is where you can also sign up to get our podcast extras, stuff you won't hear on the radio. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio, Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Mark Rickers, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Gotcher mixed today's show. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps, and thanks to you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.